and welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 19th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. We'll start with today's weather. Today will be partly sunny and breezy with a high of 54 degrees. Tonight we'll have patchy clouds with a low of 28 degrees. Saturday will be mostly cloudy and cool with a high of 51 degrees. And now we switch over to local and state news stories. Runway support. Chamber finds support in Washington for 185th project. Mason Doctor reports from Washington, D.C. The Siouxland Chamber of Commerce delegation found a receptive audience on Capitol Hill this week for its pitch to get needed infrastructure improvements at the 185th Air Refueling Wing. "I think everyone's very supportive of that project," said Barbara Sloniker, the Chamber's Executive Vice President, who was part of the delegation sent on the organization's 69th annual Washington Conference, a lobbying trip. "They're all aware of it. We've been talking about it to them for quite some time, so our tri-state delegation is definitely supportive." The Chamber group met with all 14 members of the tri-state congressional delegation on Wednesday and Thursday. The 185th has been awaiting upgrades to its runway, ramp, and 67-year-old hangar for more than 20 years. In 2003, the 185th transitioned from the relatively small, lightweight F-16 Fighting Falcon to the extremely heavy KC-135 Stratotanker. The latter functions essentially as a flying gas station, used to refuel military aircraft in midair. The Pentagon pledged as part of that transition that the 185th would get the infrastructure updates needed to support the weight of the KC-135, but the project was mothballed. Getting federal commitments to fund the 185th project was one of the Chamber's top priorities in Washington. "Funding is always the issue, right? At this point, we don't have all the funding needed to do that," Sloniker said. The 185th is allowed to operate on a day-to-day basis thanks to a Federal Aviation Administration waiver. The FAA is expected to stop giving the waiver in 2027. The Chamber's lobbying trip coincided with positive developments in the project this week. On Monday, the Sioux City Council approved federal and state agreements and a design contract to begin design work on the runway and ramp project. The hangar is not part of the current agreement. "We have full design support from the federal government through the military channels, and they are funding 100% of the design cost," Mike Collett, assistant city manager, told the Journal. The design contract was awarded to RS&H, a Duluth, Minnesota architectural engineering and consulting firm. On Tuesday, Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall noted this progress at a congressional hearing, during which Iowa Senator Joni Ernst pushed him to commit to the 185th's mission continuing in Sioux City after the Air Force eventually replaces its KC-135s with the newer KC-46 tankers. "We have started the architectural engineering activities associated with three projects at the airfield," Kendall told the Senate Armed Services Committee. "We are moving forward with those upgrades." There wasn't quite as much enthusiasm among the all-Republican tri-state congressional delegation for directing federal funds to aid Sioux City in paying for its wastewater treatment plant rebuild, estimated to cost $470 million. The Chamber delegation had hoped to find support for the project through the Federal Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, signed into law by President Joe Biden in 2021. The law provides billions of dollars for water infrastructure upgrades. The congressional delegation gave the Chamber group ideas for possible alternative funding to look into, Sloniker said, though she added she wasn't sure of the viability of those funding sources. "Earmarks are not in vogue anymore," Sloniker said. "In general, our delegation is not highly in favor of those." In the Iowa legislature, lawmakers advance income tax cut, estimated to slash Iowans' income taxes by $1 billion. Tom Barton reports from Des Moines. Republican lawmakers plan to use the state's budget surplus and taxpayer relief fund to further cut Iowans' income taxes by an estimated $1 billion next year. The legislation makes other changes, including tweaking last year's property tax overhaul that limits revenue growth for cities and counties. It also allows county supervisors to decide whether to keep or disband county compensation boards, which review the salaries for elected county officials and recommend increases. The proposals, which advanced out of committee Thursday in both the House and Senate, would accelerate previously planned state income tax reductions passed in 2022 that started to take effect this year. As is, the law would gradually reduce personal income taxes to a flat 3.9% in 2026. The bill, House Study Bill 752 and Senate Study Bill 3207, would instead lower the rate to 3.8% in 2025. Iowa's top income tax bracket this year is 5.7%, and it would be 4.82% next year if it is not accelerated by a new law. We are accelerating the promised tax cuts, taking it lower and returning an extra $1 billion back to Iowans, said Senator Dan Dawson, Republican from Council Bluffs, who chairs the Senate Ways and Means Committee that oversees tax policy. Iowa's tax revenues have largely stayed robust as the tax cuts have taken effect, leading Iowa Republicans to call for deeper tax cuts, arguing that the state is collecting more money than it needs. Iowa ended the year with a $1.83 billion surplus, $902 million in reserve funds, and $2.7 billion in the Taxpayer Relief Fund, where unspent taxes from previous years have been deposited. Lobbyists for developers, banks, and business groups praised the proposal. "We appreciate all the progress that has been made over the last several years in making our tax climate more competitive for both individuals and businesses," Brad Hartkopf, a lobbyist for the Iowa Association of Business and Industry, told senators during a subcommittee hearing. "We believe this bill takes us in another step going in that direction, and we support it." Opponents argue the savings come at the expense of underfunded public schools and health care, water quality, roads, bridges, and other services across the state. House and Senate Democratic leaders have said further income tax cuts would disproportionately benefit the wealthy, who receive the largest windfall from the falling tax brackets, and give no financial relief for the thousands of Iowans who pay no income taxes. This bill compounds a patently unfair tax system that we have. It takes us away from a tax system based on an ability to pay, said Mike Owen, deputy director of progressive advocacy group Common Good Iowa. "I would add, this is one more case of taxes directing budget choices rather than the other way around, where we could determine our needs, transparently set priorities, and find the best way to fund them." Owen argued lawmakers could have done so much better, focusing instead on targeted tax cuts for working families, such as strengthening the earned income tax credit and creating a child tax credit. Opponents worry the eventual consequences will be cuts to services that make Iowa a good place to live, work, and raise a family, including funding for schools, health care, public safety, child care, and environmental protection. The nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency estimates previously approved tax cuts will cost $1.9 billion a year by fiscal year 2028. "We continually deny that we have any unmet needs today, that we can push out the inevitable budget problems for years," Ann Disher, executive director for Common Good Iowa, told lawmakers. "But just because the damage isn't immediate doesn't mean it's not real. Inevitably, eventually, revenues will drop and surpluses will dry up." If state revenues drop below state spending during a fiscal year, the bill would take half of the difference from the state's taxpayer relief fund to cover the costs. The other half would come from the state's ending balance. Winnebago man pleads not guilty of fatal stabbing. From Omaha. A Winnebago, Nebraska man pleaded not guilty Thursday in federal court to a charge connected to a fatal stabbing that occurred in Winnebago. Tylan Walker, 20, entered his plea in U.S. District Court in Omaha to assault with a dangerous weapon with intent to do bodily harm. The charge carries a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison. A trial date was not set, and Walker was released from custody on pretrial release. Walker is accused of stabbing Darius Frazier, 19, of Winnebago, on March 30th. Frazier's family members posted on Facebook that the two were involved in an altercation in which Frazier's femoral artery was cut when he was stabbed, resulting in serious blood loss. He was taken to the hospital in Winnebago, where his heart was restarted after he had been without a pulse for 45 minutes. Frazier was flown to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center in Sioux City, where he died on April 3rd. Sioux Center man sentenced for sexual assault, from Orange City, Iowa. A Sioux Center, Iowa man who was charged with raping a woman has been sentenced to jail after pleading guilty to a lesser charge. Onofre Bernardo Mendez, 47, pleaded guilty Monday as part of a plea agreement to assault with intent to commit sexual abuse, no injury, an aggravated misdemeanor that was amended from a felony charge of third-degree sexual abuse. A charge of tampering with a witness was dismissed. In Sioux County District Court Wednesday, District Judge Todd Deck sentenced Bernardo Mendez in accordance with the jail agreement to 25 days in jail with credit for time already served. Bernardo also was sentenced to a 10-year special sentence in which he will be under court supervision as if on parole. Violations of the special sentence could result in prison sentences. He will be required to register with the Iowa State Offender Registry for life. Bernardo Mendez was arrested in February and accused of forcefully having sex with the woman against her will sometime between December 28th and January 15th. He also was charged with offering cash to the victim to influence her to drop her police report. Spencer man gets federal prison for selling meth, from Sioux City. A Spencer, Iowa man has been sentenced to more than 13 years in federal prison for selling methamphetamine. Todd Williams, 57, pleaded guilty in November in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to one count of possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine. He was sentenced Wednesday to 158 months in prison. There is no parole in the federal system. According to the U.S. Attorney's Office, authorities executed a search warrant on Williams' home on March 4, 2023, and seized approximately 2.7 pounds of meth and approximately $50,000 in cash. Williams was not home during the search, but was seen driving past the residence. He was arrested after leading law enforcement officers on a brief vehicle pursuit that reached speeds of up to 100 miles per hour. Williams was previously convicted of conspiracy to manufacture and distribute methamphetamine. And finally, Macy man faces federal sex abuse charges, from Omaha. A Macy, Nebraska man has been charged in federal court with child sexual abuse. An indictment filed Tuesday in U.S. District Court in Omaha charges Jason Walker, 53, with two counts of aggravated sexual abuse with children and two counts of abusive sexual contact with a child under age 12. Walker is accused of having sexual contact with the child during a two-year period that began about December 1, 2021, and continued until January 31st. If convicted, he could face a maximum sentence of life in prison. Ready for their close-up. Smithland, Iowa Roadhouse to be profiled as one of America's favorite restaurants. Earl Horlick reports from Smithland, Iowa. Joe Anabo places a hot-off-the-grill Angus beef patty onto a toasted bun before piling on bacon, pulled pork, a slab of cheddar, and some soft and sweet onion rings. The burger is called the Gunslinger, and it is the specialty of Buffalo Joe's Roadhouse, the unpretentious eatery that Anabo owns with his mother, Pat Anabo. Located near the Les Hills National Scenic Byway, the Anabo family's diner-esque restaurant has long been a favorite of bike clubs, motorcycle clubs, and residents of the town of Smithland, which boasts a population of 181. In a few months, Buffalo Joe's Roadhouse will be featured on America's Best Restaurants, a national media and marketing company which produces content for the site's YouTube channel as well as on other social media platforms. The film crew, along with host Daniel DeTomo, were inside the restaurant Monday for a segment that will debut in early July. America's Best Restaurants is all about bringing attention to locally owned restaurants, DeTomo said, moments before the start of the shoot. While many restaurant owners reach out to us, our production staff reached out to Buffalo Joe's based on its likes on Facebook as well as its commitment to the community. Indeed, Buffalo Joe's website spells out its mission statement. When we opened the restaurant, we wanted it to be a place where people make memories, Anabo explained. The food is just a supporting actor in the whole experience because we are really in the business of making memories. We want to be the place where someone has their first date or their anniversary dinner, he added. We want to be their sentimental favorite. However, when America's Best Restaurants first contacted Anabo earlier this year, he thought it was a scam. After doing plenty of research and following a lot of Zoom meetings, we know they're on the level, Pat Anabo said as her son prepared for the video shoot. Opened more than 3 years ago, Buffalo Joe's Roadhouse was named by Pat Anabo's grandchildren. We were on a family vacation at Custer National Park where we saw some buffalo, she remembered. Joe's beard was longer at the time, and the grandkids teased him, saying he looked like Tatanka, which is the Lakota Sioux name for buffalo. The nickname stuck, and so did Anabo's expertise at creating comfort food favorites like the Cubano chicken, a sandwich served with or grilled chicken, Swiss cheese, fried pickles, and homemade honey mustard, or the barbecue pulled pork, which has drawn raves from people who've traveled all the way from Kansas City and Texas. Since we're on the Les Hills National Scenic Byway, we get a lot of tourists, Pat Anabo said. If people from Kansas City or Texas are singing the praises of our pulled pork, we know we must be doing something right. While she watched her son be interviewed inside of Buffalo Joe's kitchen, Pat Anabo admitted it takes a special type of person to run a restaurant, especially in a small town like Smithland. It takes a lot of time and hard work, that's for sure, she said. Which is why Pat Anabo hopes that the America's Best Restaurant video will put a spotlight on Buffalo Joe's Roadhouse as well as other independently owned eateries. When you go into a chain restaurant, you'll get a chain restaurant experience, she said. When you walk into Buffalo Joe's, we want you to make a memory. And now we turn to national and world news stories. In the Trump hush money criminal trial, court picks all 12 jurors. Ex-president accused of hiding payments prior to 2016 election. From New York. A jury of 12 people was seated Thursday in former President Donald Trump's history-making hush money trial, propelling the proceedings closer to opening statements. The court quickly turned to selecting alternate jurors. The first ever trial of a former American president will almost certainly feature unflattering testimony about Trump's personal life before he was elected, with allegations that he falsified business records to suppress stories about his sexual relationships. The jury selection process appeared wobbly earlier in the day when two jurors were dismissed, one after expressing doubt about her ability to be fair following disclosure of details about her identity, and the other over concerns that some of his answers in court might have been inaccurate. But lawyers, who began the day with only 5 jurors, settled on the remaining 7 for the panel in quick succession, along with one alternate. Judge Juan Mershon says his goal is to have 6 alternates. In other developments, prosecutors asked for Trump to be held in contempt over a series of social media posts this week, and the judge barred reporters from identifying jurors' employers after expressing privacy concerns. The district attorney's office on Monday sought a $3,000 fine for Trump for 3 Truth Social posts they said violated the order. Since then, prosecutors said he made 7 additional posts they believe violate the order. The judge had already scheduled a hearing for next week on the contempt sanctions. The hush money trial centers on a $130,000 payment that former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen made shortly before the 2016 election to porn actor Stormy Daniels to prevent her claims of a sexual encounter with Trump from becoming public. Prosecutors say Trump obscured the true nature of the payments in internal records when his company reimbursed Cohen, who pleaded guilty to federal charges in 2018 and is expected to be a star witness for the prosecution. Appeals and legal wrangling have caused delays in the other three cases, charging Trump with plotting to overturn the 2020 election results and with illegally hoarding classified documents. In the election interference case, U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta in Washington denied defense lawyers' request to put the civil cases seeking to hold Trump responsible for the January 6, 2021 riot on hold, while the criminal case accusing him of conspiring to overturn his election loss to President Joe Biden plays out. From the Arabian Peninsula, UAE struggles with floodwaters. Heaviest rainfall ever recorded impairs busy airport in desert nation. John Gambrell reports from Dubai, United Arab Emirates. The United Arab Emirates tried to wring itself out Thursday after the heaviest recorded rainfall ever to hit the desert nation, with its main airport allowing more flights even as floodwater still covered portions of major highways and communities. Dubai International Airport, the world's busiest for international travel, allowed global carriers on, Thursday morning to again fly into Terminal 1 at the airfield. Long-haul carrier Emirates, crucial to east-west travel, began allowing local passengers to arrive at Terminal 3, their base of operations. However, Dubai Airport CEO Paul Griffiths said in an interview with the Associated Press that the airfield needed at least another 24 hours to resume operations close to its usual schedule. Meanwhile, one desert community in Dubai saw floodwaters continue to rise Thursday to as much as 3 feet as civil defense officials struggled to pump out the water. "We were looking at the radar thinking, goodness, if this hits, then it's going to be cataclysmic," Griffiths said of the storm, and indeed it was. The airport ended up needing 22 tankers with vacuum pumps to get water off its grounds. Griffiths acknowledged that taxiways flooded during the rains, though the airport's runways remained free of water to safely operate. Online videos of a Fly Dubai flight landing with its reversed thrust spraying out water caught the world's attention. The UAE, a hereditarily ruled autocratic nation on the Arabian Peninsula, typically sees little rainfall in its arid desert climate. However, a massive storm forecasters warned about for days blew through the country's 7 sheikdoms. By the end of Tuesday, more than 5.59 inches of rainfall soaked Dubai over 24 hours. An average year sees 3.73 inches of rain at Dubai International Airport. Other areas of the country saw even more precipitation. On Thursday, people waded through oil-slicked floodwater to reach cars, checking to see if their engines still ran. Tanker trucks and with vacuums began reaching some areas outside of Dubai's downtown core for the first time as well. Meanwhile, intense floods also struck neighboring Oman in recent days. Authorities on Thursday raised the death toll from those storms to at least 21 killed. U.S. vetoes membership for Palestine at UN. Resolution would have almost surely passed UN General Assembly. From the United Nations. The United States vetoed a widely backed UN resolution Thursday that would have paved the way for full United Nations membership for the state of Palestine. The vote in the 15-member Security Council was 12 in favor, the United States opposed, and 2 abstentions. The resolution would have recommended that the 193-member General Assembly, where there are no vetoes, approve Palestine becoming the 194th member of the United Nations. Some 140 countries already recognize the state of Palestine, so its admission would have been approved. Before the vote, U.S. Deputy State Department spokesman Vedant Patel, said the United States has been very clear consistently that premature actions in New York, even with the best intentions, will not achieve statehood for the Palestinian people. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas first delivered the Palestinian Authority's application for UN membership in 2011. The Palestinians revived their bid for UN membership in early April, backed by the 140 countries that recognize Palestine as an independent state. U.S., U.K. issue new round of sanctions after attack. Iran launched assault on Israel as fear grows of wider regional war. From Washington. The U.S. and U.K. on Thursday imposed a new round of sanctions on Iran as concern grows that Tehran's unprecedented attack on Israel could fuel a wider war in the Middle East. The sanctions are meant to hold Iran accountable for its weekend attack and to deter further such activity. The practical impact is likely to be limited because many of the targeted companies already were subject to U.S. sanctions, and the individuals singled out for new sanctions are unlikely to have assets in U.S. jurisdiction. President Joe Biden said in a statement that he directed U.S. Treasury to continue to impose sanctions that further degrade Iran's military industries. Let it be clear to all those who enable or support Iran's attacks, he said, we will not hesitate to take all necessary action to hold you accountable. Iran's attack on Israel early Sunday came in response to what it says was an Israeli strike on Iran's consulate in Syria this month. Israel's military chief said Monday that his country will respond to the Iranian attack, while world leaders caution against retaliation, trying to avoid a spiral of violence. NATO, EU officials urge G7 to boost Ukraine aid. From Capri, Italy. Top NATO and European Union officials urged foreign ministers from leading industrialized nations Thursday to provide more air defense systems and artillery to Ukraine, warning continued delays could tilt the war in Moscow's favor. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell addressed foreign ministers of G7 nations meeting on the Italian resort island of Capri. Russia's war on Ukraine and surging tensions in the Middle East over Iran's attack on Israel over the weekend topped the agenda. Stoltenberg welcomed signs the U.S. Congress might soon vote on a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine. Recent pledges from the Netherlands and Denmark and Germany's delivery of a new Patriot missile battery, but said more long-term and sustainable aid is necessary. Poland, Germany accuse men in spying schemes. From Warsaw, Poland. A Polish man was arrested on allegations of being ready to spy on behalf of Russia's military intelligence in an alleged plot to assassinate Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, Polish prosecutors said Thursday. The office of Poland's national prosecutor said the man, identified only as Paweł K., under Polish privacy laws, was arrested in Poland on Wednesday and accused of being prepared to pass airport security information to Russian agents. If convicted, the man could face up to 8 years in prison, the statement said. In Germany, two German-Russian men were arrested on suspicion of espionage, one accused of agreeing to carry out attacks on potential targets, including U.S. military facilities, in hopes of sabotaging aid for Ukraine. The two, identified only as Dieter S. and Alexander J., due to German privacy rules, were arrested Wednesday, Germany's federal prosecutors said. Once again, you are listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 19th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. National and World News continues. Protests. New York police removed a pro-Palestinian protest encampment Thursday at Columbia University and arrested 108 demonstrators. Several students involved in the protest said they were also suspended from Columbia and Barnard College, including Isra Hirsi, the daughter of U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar, a Democrat from Minnesota. Conservation. The Biden administration finalized a new rule for public land management Thursday to put conservation on more equal footing with oil drilling, grazing, and other industries on government-owned properties. Republican members of Congress said they will seek to invalidate the rule. Tesla. Electric vehicle maker Tesla's stock tumbled below $150 per share Thursday, giving up all of the gains it made over the past year as it reels from falling sales and steep discounts intended to lure more buyers. Haiti. The Biden administration sent about 50 Haitians back to their country Thursday, authorities said, the first deportation flight in several months to the Caribbean nation struggling with surging gang violence. Ohio. Part of Ohio's capital, Columbus, was evacuated for hours Thursday out of fear that a fire in a truck's trailer might cause lithium-ion batteries to explode. No injuries were reported. And finally, syphilis. With syphilis cases in U.S. newborns skyrocketing, the American College of Obstetricians and gynecologists recommended Thursday that all pregnant patients be screened 3 times for the sexually transmitted infection. And now we turn to sports stories, starting with Major League Baseball. Pepio goes 6 innings to lift Rays past Angels. From St. Petersburg, Florida. Ryan Pepio allowed 1 run and 3 hits in 6 strong innings. Ahmed Rosario hit an RBI triple in Tampa Bay's 2-run first, and the Rays beat the Los Angeles Angels 2-1 on Thursday to split their 4-game series. Pepio struck out 7 and walked 3. He was acquired in a trade in which Rays ace Tyler Glasnow was dealt to the Los Angeles Dodgers. Colin Posch, the third Rays reliever, worked out of a jam with 2 on and 2 outs in the 9th for his 2nd save in 3 chances. Struggling closer Pete Fairbanks, who has a 9 ERA, pitched in the previous 2 games. Rosario extended his hitting streak to 10 games with an RBI triple that made it 1-0 in the Rays' opening inning against Griffin Canning. He has 9 RBIs over the stretch. Limping Astros not pushing panic button. From Houston. Through 20 games, the Houston Astros have managed just 6 wins and are in last place in the American League West. Their pitching staff trails only Colorado with a 5.24 ERA, and big money new closer Josh Hader has given up the same number of earned runs in 10 games as he did in 61 last year. Despite this, these veteran Astros, who have reached the AL Championship Series 7 consecutive times, have no doubt they'll turn things around. If there's a team that can do it, it's this team, shortstop Jeremy Peña said. First-year manager Joe Espada, who was hired in January to replace the retired Dusty Baker, discussed his team's early struggles. It's not ideal, he said. It's not what we expected to come out of the chute playing this type of baseball. But you know what? This is where we're at, and we've got to pick it up and play better. Many of Houston's problems have stemmed from a poor performance by a rotation that has been decimated by injuries. Ace Justin Verlander and fellow starter Jose Urquidy haven't pitched this season because of injuries, and lefty Framber Valdez made just 2 starts before landing on the injured list with a sore elbow. Ronel Blanco, who threw a no-hitter in his season debut April 1st, has pitched well and is 2-0 with a .86 ERA in 3 starts this season. Christian Javier is also off to a good start, going 2-0 with a 1.54 ERA in 4 starts. But the team has won just 2 games not started by those 2 pitchers. However, Espada wouldn't blame the rotation for Houston's current position. It's been a little bit of a roller coaster how we've played overall, he said. The middle relief has been better, and sometimes it hasn't been. So we've just got to put it all together and then play more as a team. And once we start doing that, we'll be in good shape. The good news for the Astros is that Verlander will make his season debut Friday night when they open a series at Washington, and Valdez should return soon after him. Hader signed a 5-year, $95 million contract this offseason to give the Astros a shutdown 7-8-9 combination at the back end of their bullpen with Brian Abreu and Ryan Pressly, but the 5-time All-Star is off to a bumpy start. He allowed 4 runs in the 9th inning of a 6-1 loss to the Braves on Monday night, and has yielded 8 earned runs this season after giving up the same number in 56 1/3 innings for San Diego last year. Houston's offense, led by Altuve, Yordan Alvarez, and Kyle Tucker, ranks 3rd in the majors with a 2.68 batting average and is tied for 3rd with 24 homers this season. But the Astros have struggled with runners in scoring position and often failed to get a big hit in close games. First baseman Jose Abreu, who is in the second year of a 3-year, $58.5 million contract, has just 1 extra base hit in 16 games, raising questions about why the 37-year-old remains in the lineup every day. Espada brushed off criticism of Abreu and said he knows the 2020 AL MVP can break out of his early slump. Because of history, Espada said, the back of his baseball card, he can do it. Everyone insists there's no panic in this team, which won its second World Series in 2022. I think they played enough baseball to know how to control themselves and how to come back to the plan we have, which is winning games, Altuve said. In other Major League Baseball games, Rangers 9, Tigers 7. Leody Taveras scored the winning run on a fielder's choice in the 8th inning and added an RBI single in the 9th to lead the Texas Rangers to a 9-7 victory over the Detroit Tigers on Thursday. Taveras doubled with 1 out, advanced to 3rd on Marcus Semien's fielder's choice grounder, and scored on Corey Seager's grounder to break a 7-all tie. Taveras added an insurance run with a 2-out hit in the 9th. The game marked the Major League debut of Texas starter Jack Leiter, the number 2 overall pick in the 2021 draft, who was brought up from AAA Round Rock. He allowed 7 runs, all earned, on 8 hits in 3 2/3 innings. He walked 3 and struck out 3. He is the son of Al Leiter, who won 162 games in 19 Major League seasons. Guardians 5, Red Sox 4. Carlos Carrasco gave up 2 runs in 5 2/3 solid innings, and Andrés Giménez had 2 RBIs to lead Cleveland to a road victory over Boston. Ramon Laureano, Josh Naylor, and Jose Ramirez also drove in runs for the Guardians, who took 3 of 4 from the Red Sox. Carrasco threw 56 of his 89 pitches for strikes and allowed 2 hits while striking out 5 and walking 3. And finally, Giants 5, Diamondbacks nothing. Logan Webb retired 19 straight batters on his way to 7 smooth innings as San Francisco beat Arizona to open a 4-game series at home. Webb struck out 5 and induced 13 ground ball outs, allowing just 2 hits and a walk in a game that took only 2 hours 12 minutes. Now we turn to the NBA. Injuries to play key roles in Friday's play-in finales. From Miami. When injuries affect the Miami Heat, coach Eric Spoelstra almost always delivers the same 3-word outlook. We have enough, he says. That theory is about to be tested and will be a theme in the NBA's win-or-go-home play-in finales on Friday night. All 4 teams, Miami and Chicago in the Eastern Conference, New Orleans and Sacramento in the Western Conference, have serious injury concerns going into their matchups to decide the number 8 seeds on the playoff bracket. Miami and New Orleans have home court edges Friday. The winners will face number 1 Boston and number 1 Oklahoma City in round 1, starting Sunday. The Heat will be without Jimmy Butler, sprained right MCL, and Terry Rozier, neck, for their game against the Bulls, who had guard Alex Caruso go down to a sprained ankle in Wednesday's win over Atlanta. The Pelicans will be without Zion Williamson, who scored 40 points in a losing effort against the Los Angeles Lakers on Tuesday night before injuring his left hamstring in the final minutes. On Wednesday, the team announced Williamson would be sidelined at least 2 weeks. The Bulls-Heat game is a rematch of the East play-in finale last year, a game where Chicago led by 3 with 3 minutes and 47 seconds left and got outscored 15-1 the rest of the way. Sacramento got into the West play-in finale by ousting Golden State on Tuesday. New Orleans missed a chance to be the West's number 7 seed by falling to the Los Angeles Lakers on Tuesday. In other NBA news, Moyer Gleish among referees for playoffs. Ashley Moyer Gleish checked her email just before heading to the airport on Saturday for a trip to what she thought would be her final game of the season. That's when the news came in. She has more games to do. Moyer Gleish will soon become only the second woman in NBA history to referee a playoff game. She was one of 36 referees announced by the league Thursday as its referee selections for round one of the playoffs starting this weekend. "It's surreal," Moyer Gleish said. "It really is." She joins Violet Palmer as the only woman picked by the NBA for a playoff assignment. Palmer worked 9 playoff games between 2006 and 2012. Moyer Gleish, a former Division II player at Millersville University in her native Pennsylvania, was promoted to the full-time NBA officiating ranks in November 2018. She's worked more than 200 regular season games in her 6 seasons. The league trims the officiating roster down for each round, typically culminating with a 12-person list for the NBA Finals. Leonard, questionable for Clippers Game 1. From Los Angeles, Kawhi Leonard has been fighting very, very stubborn inflammation in his surgically repaired right knee for nearly 3 weeks, and he'll be listed as questionable for the Los Angeles Clippers playoff opener against the Dallas Mavericks. The 4th-seeded Clippers host Luka Doncic and the 5th-seeded Mavs on Sunday. And now in National Hockey League news. Cup playoffs appear wide open. General manager Don Waddell likes how his Carolina Hurricanes finished the season, winning 16 of their final 21 games. He knows it means nothing now. "Your points get erased and you all start with zeros," Waddell said. "Playoffs are a different time. That's what's great about the NHL. Once you get to the playoffs, it's wide open. This year, more than many in the recent past. Unlike last year, when Boston broke league records for the most wins and points in a season, there is no clear favorite to hoist the Stanley Cup. Carolina, Florida, defending champion Vegas, Dallas, Winnipeg, Edmonton, and the league-best New York Rangers are among the many contenders who could be the last team standing in June. "I don't think there's that separation," former player-turned-TNT analyst Ed Olszewski said. "I think that there is 8 or 9 or 10 teams that I really feel could win the Stanley Cup." Carolina, which opens against the New York Islanders, are 13-2 Cup favorites, according to BetMGM Sportsbook, followed by Florida at 7-1, Dallas at 15-2, Colorado, Edmonton, and the Rangers all at 8-1, Boston at 11-1, Vegas at 12-1 to repeat, and Toronto at 14-1. The Canucks and Jets are listed at 15-1, and 2020-2021 Cup-winning Tampa Bay is 25-1, even with top goaltender Andre Vasilevsky rounding back into form. "He's at his best when the games are on the line, and we look for that once again this year," 2020 playoff MVP Victor Hedman said. "It's obviously so fun to have the best goalie in the world behind you when the playoffs start." And these games on Thursday, Kraken 4, Wild 3. Ty Cartier tipped in a slap shot by Oliver Bjorkstrand for the tie-breaking goal with 2 minutes and 40 seconds remaining, and Seattle won at Minnesota. Ryan Hartman scored 6-on-4 on a power play for the Wild with 1 minute 5 seconds left, and goalie Marc-Andre Fleury pulled, but Kraken goalie Joey Decord, who had 21 saves, and the defense held up. Jets 4, Canucks 2. Nikita Chibrikov scored the game winner in his NHL debut, and Cole Perfetti added 2 goals as host Winnipeg beat Vancouver. Flames 5, Sharks 1. Blake Coleman scored his 30th goal, and Mackenzie Weegar netted his 20th as Calgary scored a home victory over San Jose. Avalanche 5, Oilers 1. Valeri Nichushkin scored twice. Nathan MacKinnon added 2 assists to break the franchise's single-season points mark, and host Colorado beat Edmonton to cruise into the playoffs. In other news around the league, it's official, Coyotes off to Salt Lake City from Tempe, Arizona. The Arizona Coyotes are officially headed to Salt Lake City. The NHL Board of Governors voted unanimously Thursday to approve a $1.2 billion sale from Alex Mruelo to Utah Jazz owners Ryan and Ashley Smith, clearing the way for the franchise's move to Utah next season. The deal includes a provision for Arizona to get an expansion team if a new arena is built within the next 5 years. The deal will be facilitated through the NHL, with $200 million going to league owners as a relocation fee. Devils GM part of coaching search from Newark, New Jersey. General manager Tom Fitzgerald is looking for a new coach for the New Jersey Devils, and interim skipper Travis Green remains in the running for the job. Speaking 3 days after the Devils ended a disappointing season by missing the playoffs, Fitzgerald said he hopes to have a full-time coach in place for the NHL draft in late June. Fitzgerald wants his coach to be a person who can communicate with his players while holding them accountable. And finally, Golden Knights. Coach Bruce Cassidy said he is still trying to figure out whether to split time between goaltenders Logan Thompson and Aiden Hill, or to hand the bulk of the work to one over the other. And from the PGA Tour, Poston has early lead at Hilton Head. Masters champion Scheffler down 6. From Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Scotty Scheffler is running on fumes after an exhausting Masters victory just 4 days ago. He hit a shank from a bunker. He nearly lost his mind from mud on his golf ball, and he still managed a 2-under-69 at the RBC Heritage on Thursday. JT Poston set the pace on an idyllic day on Hilton Head Island with 9 birdies, 6 of them in a 7-hole stretch, for a 63 that gave him a 2-shot lead over Colin Morikawa and Seamus Power. Ludvig Åberg, the runner-up at Augusta, was in the group another shot behind. Rory McIlroy birdied his last 2 holes to salvage a scrappy day with the irons for 67. Thousands of fans lined the fairways of Harbortown to see Scheffler, the Masters champion who is going for his 4th win in his last 5 tournaments. There were times Scheffler didn't look like the number one player in the world, and he figured that would be the case with little time to prepare. That's why I tried to give myself a little extra bit of grace on the course today, but because, yeah, emotionally a little drained, mentally definitely a bit drained, he said. All but 16 players in the 69-man field were at the Masters, at least for part of the week. Poston closed with a 70 at Augusta National and arrived at Hilton Head Island with a little excitement away from golf. This is the first time traveling with his month-old daughter, Catherine Scott. They're calling her Scotty, a family name from both sides of the family. Good time to be called Scotty, Poston said with a smile. Poston chipped in from 65 feet on the par 3 fourth hole to begin a remarkable run. 3 straight birdies from the 10-foot range followed, and then a 15-foot birdie putt on the short par 4 ninth, and another birdie from 10 feet to start the back 9. For Morikawa, it was more validation he's on the right track. The two-time major winner was among those who had a share of the lead Sunday at the Masters until he took a pair of double bogeys around the turn. He wound up in a tie for third. A lot of swing thoughts I've kind of been flipping the book through worked for one day or 2 days and then it's gone, Morikawa said. But look, it lasted all the way through the Masters. It's lasted through here. What I'm doing, it's working. I've just got to stick to that and understand why it's working and just go out there and play golf. Scheffler and Jordan Spieth were getting all the attention in the group behind Poston. Scheffler as the dominant player in golf, Spieth because his entertainment level is high. The fans probably weren't expecting a shank, and neither was Scheffler. It happened on the third hole. He was in a bunker right of the green and hit it off the hosel of the club at a 45-degree angle away from the pin, over the green. He chipped to 6 feet and missed the putt, making double bogey. I shank it a decent amount, but never in competition, Scheffler said. I tried to give myself a little bit of grace there. It clearly was just a mental lapse, and I wasn't quite into it yet. I had a much better back nine. That had its moments, too, all on one hole. The 11th gives him fits off the tee, and he finally drilled one, only to see a clump of mud on his ball. His approached headed left and kept going as Scheffler shouted, "Mud ball!" And the frustration was evident. He talked to himself harshly down the fairway, especially seeing the ball carom off a slope into the bunker, leaving him an impossible shot. Scheffler did well to blast out to the fringe, and then he holed the putt for par. I was obviously frustrated with that type of break, and then to get up there and knock the putt in was a nice feeling, he said. Used it as some good momentum for the closing stretch. He hit wedge to 4 feet for birdie on the 16th, made a 15-foot birdie putt on the par 3 17th, and ended the day with another round below par. Scheffler now has 37 consecutive rounds at par or better, dating to the Tour Championship last August. In other PGA news, Bryan holds early lead in Dominican Republic. From Punta Cana, Dominican Republic. Wesley Bryan chipped in for eagle early and for birdie late, giving him a 9-under-63 on Thursday for a 3-shot lead in the Corrales Punta Cana Championship, a PGA Tour event held the same week as a place he'd rather be. Bryan birdied his last two holes to stretch his lead to 3 shots over 5 players, a group that includes former PGA Tour winners Charlie Hoffman and Troy Merritt, along with Tour rookie Parker Couda. Hoffman is 47 and already had a surprise start to his year with a playoff loss in the Phoenix Open. He's trying to build on that and added a trip to the Dominican Republic. He started on the back nine, played bogey-free on a breezy day, and finished with 3 straight birdies. As an opposite-field event, the winner gets into the PGA Championship and receives a 2-year exemption, which more than makes up for not getting a spot in the Masters. This year, every event means a ton, Hoffman said. Everyone knows how important it is to get in that top 50, top 70, to get in the playoffs. I got off to a good start this year, struggled a little bit. I didn't struggle, just missed a couple cuts by a few shots. The group at 67 included Billy Horschel and Pearson Coody, the twin brother of Parker. Their grandfather is Charles Coody, the 1971 Masters champion. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, April 19th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.